You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
The March of 1991 was a turning point in India's history. The Chandrasekhar government presented an interim budget on the 4th of March. Finance Minister Yashwant Sinha spoke in the budget speech of a fragile economic situation and a macroeconomic crisis, but could not take corrective steps required because the government was politically too weak. By May 1991, international rating agencies had downgraded India to below investment grade. India was on the brink of default on its international obligations, something that had never happened before. Mr. Sinha authorized the State Bank of India to sell 20 tons of gold from the Government of India's stock to the Union Bank of Switzerland. He also authorized negotiations for pledging 47 tons of gold from the reserves as collateral for a loan of $600 million from the Bank of Japan and the Bank of England. They insisted that the gold should be physically shipped to their vaults in London. On 21st June 1991, a new government headed by P.V. Narasimha Rao was sworn in. It brought the crisis under control and reversed the economic policies of interventionism India had stuck to in the first four decades post-independence. These decisions changed the Indian economy unimaginably. Welcome to India's Reform Story. I'm your host Pooja Mehra. I'm an independent journalist and podcaster and the author of The Lost Decade, 2008-18, How India's Growth Story Devolved into Growth Without a Story. India's Reform Story is a seven-part podcast. In a series of seven conversations with economists, policymakers, and commentators, I will unpack the story behind India's reforms and find out what went on behind the scenes and how successive prime ministers from Atal Bihari Vajpayee to Narendra Modi have taken these reforms forward. The Modi government's reform initiatives are not at an advanced stage yet. It is not clear what shape they may finally take and what results they will finally yield, how they will ultimately change lives and the economy. I asked Dr. Surjit Bhalla to detail the important reforms initiatives of the Modi government, especially the changes introduced in the farm laws that are being resisted by protesting farmers. Dr. Bhalla is an executive director for India on the board of the International Monetary Fund.
Dr. Bhalla, as you know, farmers have been protesting in Delhi's very cruel winter about the changes introduced in the farm laws by the Modi government. And many economists have said that the political handling of these changes and the situation that they have triggered could have been better. But I wanted to ask you that, you know, if you were to explain to the protesting farmers why the Modi government's reforms are necessary and positive and should not be feared, what would you say to people who have these concerns?
The farm laws allow more freedom to each individual farmer to do as she finds best. If she finds the APMC market the best, she can continue to do so. There's nothing in the laws that says she shall not go to an APMC. It only allows you more freedom. And that is what I mean. This is the very first time I've seen protests without any kind of a logical basis. If you can offer me something that they are protesting, a protest means I demand, I am being hurt, and it is unfair, and I demand a change. What is a change that they want other than to go back to the status quo, which is something that hurts the other farmers?
They have three concerns from what I gather. One is they fear their land will be taken away. How exactly, I'm also not sure. Two, they want a legal guarantee for MSPs. Three, they fear that this is going to eliminate the role of the mandis over a period of time and leave them at the mercy of corporate buyers only. I think those seem to be, according to my understanding of the situation, their fears.
So let us take each one in turn. First, that the land will be taken away from them. Is that what I understand you to say? Well, let us assume the laws were not changed. So according to the farmers, what is it in the laws that allows land to be taken away? That is not there in the present status quo. Then you have about corporate farmers exploiting them. Well, you know, they can choose not to sell to the corporate. What the farmer can do is organize the other farmers not to sell to the corporate. One, she cannot sell, may not sell to the corporate. Absolutely fine. That's in her right. Nothing in the law says she has to sell to a corporate. Nothing in the law says that she cannot democratically go and talk to the other farmers. Oh, don't sell to the corporate because, you know, they're going to exploit you. So that takes care of that argument. Then we are left with a legal guarantee for the MSP. So they want a new law. So far, there has not been a legal guarantee for the MSP. I won't even go into how exploitative the MSP is for the poor farmers. Let's not get in there. Unless you want to ask, I will respond. So they want a legal guarantee for the MSPs, which was never before existed, either in India or anywhere else in the world. So these are the three objections that you found were somewhat reasonable. And I hope I've shown that they are beyond reason.
Would you like to make a case for income support instead of the distortionary MSP?
Yeah. Now, income support, you know, this is one of the major reforms that the Modi government has brought about over the last 5 years. I'm glad you asked that. Direct benefit transfers, which is income support. They already have an income support of 6,000 rupees per farmer, etc. We can discuss that. I think DBTs is a very efficient way to solve income distribution problems. Okay. Now, I'll tell you why these farmers who are protesting will not like that. You may be offering the income support argument. I'm offering the income support argument. But any sensible income support argument has to be based on what income you have. If you are very, very rich, I'm sure you're not arguing that Ambani should be given income support. These farmers, these rich farmers, as I tried to show in the article, are in the top 2% of all income earners. All income earners in India, they are in the top 2%. You think they should be getting income support? That is why your recommendation and my recommendation of income support will not be accepted by these farmers, because they won't get the income support. But the people, you worked on poverty, I worked on poverty, the people who should be helped are not being helped. So one last point on this, on the farmers, but I'm happy to go for, you know, the Punjab government, which is where the most of the protesters are Punjabs, Punjabi Sikhs, most of them Sikhs. Now, and you know, they're finding this, the Punjabi Sikhs are finding this, the MSP system, the existing system, etc., very profitable. They're not sending people out to the army anymore. They'd rather just stay on the farm and be in the top 2% earners. So when the Punjab government itself got a report, I think it's dated June, on response to COVID, which was has a foreword by the chief minister, very eminent, some of the most eminent economists in India worked on it, Montek Ahluwalia and Ashok Gulati, amongst others. They recommended exactly the same laws.
Although there is some criticism of the manner in which it has taken shape and how it needs to be corrected, but yet, you know, GST is a reform, if you could talk about the merits of it.
No, I don't think the GST needs any defense. It was agreed upon by all political parties. It was one of the most sensible reforms, much needed, unanimous. Though I'm waiting for some economists to come out and say maybe the GST is bad economics, but or bad politics for that matter. So let me know if there is somebody who does that. But, you know, this had, the GST is universal. Let me go out on a limb and say universal support. International organizations, domestic organizations, opposition economists, party economists, cross-party lines. And it's a work in progress. You know, it's not an, look, it got introduced in June of 2017, barely 3 years ago. It's a complete revamp of the way we do trade in India across states. And there are computational issues involved. There is compliance issues involved. There's escape issues. You know, in India, the tax compliance rate is low. We are just like we're very good at imagining protests. We are very good at escaping taxes. So it's a challenge. And I must say, and I, you know, wrote about this very same issue when I was in India, that I've been very pleasantly surprised as to how consensual the GST reforms have been. You know, they've come a long way from where they started in 17. And I think there's a lot further to go. Many of us feel there should be only two rates. Some of us feel there should be only one rate. All of us, I think that the peak rate is too high. So it is a work in progress. I think it's one of the most significant reforms. I think the agricultural reform will be even more significant than this for India because 40% of the people workforce is in agriculture. I think it'll transform agriculture, but we can discuss. So I think the GST is not perfect, needs reform, is continuously being reformed. They have got a procedure set up, the National Council, they meet, the finance ministers meet. It's a gem of a reform. And I think, you know, that's not to say it's working perfectly, not at all. And it's been very open. All sides have been very open. And that's as it should be.
And the corporate tax rate cuts announced by Finance Minister Nirmala Sitharaman, a lot of people criticize it because they see it as a pro-rich move. But, you know, the economics of it, and especially given the international comparisons, internationally tax rates have been going down and India does compete with other investment destinations. So if you would like to say something about that as a simplification measure.
A couple of things on the corporate tax rate. It's interesting you see, you state, and I factually, that the objection to it is that it favors the rich. But, you know, we've just been talking for 20 minutes about the 2% richest farmers in India. And some of these economists are supporting these 2%. So I think, you know, you've studied Indian economics and politics enough. When in doubt, say it supports the rich. But curiously, I really want to emphasize that on the farm laws, they haven't said that the existing farm laws support the rich. So I think we can dismiss that argument. The second part of it, and I think, again, the corporate tax cut, you know, left open. And I think it was a brilliant move. And I said it ex ante way before. And as part of our HLAG report, arguing that we needed our tax rates to be competitive, internationally competitive, precisely what you just said. I think, you know, when the finance minister, when she announced the tax cut, she said that new firms would be at 15%, or new firms would be at 15%. So, in other words, I think there is room for further cuts. I would personally think the analysis suggests that our corporate tax rates should be cut further. But, you know, we have to worry about, look, this will favor the rich. So,
also revenue implications.
You know, look, I have been a long, long, ardent believer in the Laffer curve. And indeed, the Indian personal income tax rate, as well as, you know, I think the form of the direct tax code is sorely needed. And I think a large part of our problems arise because of compliance. And compliance is directly affected by the rate of taxation. Let's do a simple mental calculation. You know, in order to evade taxes, you spend in through various channels about 5 to 10 percentage points in order to bring your tax rate down. Now, it's much better for the government to get that money. So, you know, and that's study after study has shown this across the world, not just in India, that there is a Laffer curve. Very simply, that at zero rate of taxation, you'll get zero revenue. At 100% rate of taxation, you'll get zero revenue. So, and it's, you know, it's an empirical inverted U, and we have been quite to the right side. So we have garnered less revenue than we should have. So I think on corporate taxes, that was a big significant cut. But, you know, remember, our tax rate came after the U.S. reduced its corporate tax, and other competitors have also reduced. So you have to keep up. You know, this is part of globalization, that I think capital is very, very mobile between regions, between countries, and they will seek and go wherever the tax rate is the most advantageous. Now, all countries or no country will go to a 0% tax rate, or, you know, but you have to be competitive. If you want me to, and I've done some studies on it, a corporate tax rate of about 15% seems to be where most of the countries converge to. So we are, and that was very much, we had in the HLAG report 18% as the corporate tax rate, recommended tax rate. And that was, you know, there were 12 of us in there, 12 experts, and I'll go along with that, that at a first step, we should move towards about 18%.
The direct tax code should be adopted and implemented, because the Indian tax law is now very old. It was first written in the 1960s, I think, and it's been amended so many times. It's confusing in many places. It contradicts different parts of it, contradict each other, and it's just no longer in tune with, it hasn't kept in with the changing modern economy.
Yeah, I will sound like a broken record, but I've had the privilege of attending the finance minister's meetings with economists every year for the last 15, 20 years. And I have said very exactly what you're also arguing for. We need a reform of the direct tax code. And again, this is something that has a cross-party, the beginning of the direct tax code. Actually, it's a very interesting history. It started with under Bajpayee and the Kelkar report, which I had the privilege of working on back in 2003-04 on reform of the direct tax code and reform of the indirect tax. So, and ever since then, there was a report in, I think, 2008-09 on the reform of the direct tax code. And then there was yet another one, the Arvind Modi report. And each new report, I think, is better than the last one. I have some, you know, slightly difference of opinion with the Arvind Modi report, as economists always will. You know, I had, along with Arvind Virmani, argued for a flat tax back in 2016-17. And then we met with a lot of objections. So we, I think, moved it to a two-rate tax code. So if you're asking for my view, it's part of the public record. And I think the peak tax rate, income tax rate, should not be anything more than 20%. All in all, I think especially the foreign investment opening up has been absolutely first rate. You know, it couldn't have been done better. And, you know, the record of this government, and I wrote about this 3 years ago, so therefore it's only accelerated since then, on economic reforms is really extraordinary. And, you know, at that time, I wrote that there have been more economic reforms in the last 5 years than in the previous, since 1991. So in all the years since 91. So, you know, you take the GST, you take the direct benefit transfers, you take the JAM Trinity, you know, the poverty, the direct benefit support to farmers. You know, there's a IBC, which we haven't talked about, and the only reason I think this also a mega reform And, you know, as we still have long ways to go. One other thing, while we are talking on economic reforms, that I want to point out should be of interest to you and your readers and your listeners, is that, you know, the IMF has come up with a policy tracker, which you know, as to how the countries have responded to COVID. And the policy tracker takes into account the short-term policies that previous governments, 180 governments around the world, have done to attack the pandemic. There hasn't been a parallel attempt, and I'm substantially well on the way to do that, that to look at the structural reforms that have been brought in by the countries. Remember, you are one of those. I also fully subscribe to the notion of never waste a crisis. And India has been extraordinary in not wasting the crisis, in bringing about substantial economic reforms. And if you do a study, which I hope to publish soon, there are about 10 countries, that's it, that undertook structural reforms during this time period. And India is way ahead of anybody else, any other country, on bringing about structural reforms. So, you know, all in all, leaving politics aside, I think the judgment has to be that this has been an extraordinary time for economic reforms in India, and the government needs to be congratulated on it.
Do you want to say something on what these structural reforms are seeking to accomplish in terms of, is it a deepening or a widening of the market economy? So in which case it would be a continuation of the economic thinking that has guided broadly whatever reforms that have taken place after 1991, you know, be it in the Vajpayee government or in the Narasimha Rao government? Or is it some new ideology? Because there is a mood globally, you know, where trust, once again, in markets is sort of reducing. So what's sort of the guiding principle of these?
And, you know, very good question. And my assessment of the guiding principle is that basically there are two components to the reforms, of the Modi reforms. And let me give what I consider the less important one first, which is to provide more freedom, more economic freedom, more market-oriented policies that increase the openness of the market, increase competition. At the same time, and this is the most significant reform of this period, is what they've done for the bottom 50, 60, 70% of the population. The reforms there, for example, in terms of sanitation, in terms of improvement of the welfare of the 60, 70%, the DBT is there, the Jam Trinity is there, bank accounts. Just look at the bank accounts for women. And, you know, they have shot up. Then it's not, I remember that the criticism was, oh, the bank accounts have been opened, but they're not using it. Well, the latest survey, I'm sure you've seen that, shows a very large increase in access to bank accounts and use of bank accounts by women. So I think in terms of gender equality, and which is really, you don't need gender equality, and people, women of your class don't need gender equality, but of my class, be that as it may, but, you know, bottom 70% women have really benefited, and the bottom 50% have even benefited more. So I think this idea, and, you know, I discussed this and other people, it's not a new idea, that the more the world gets, and certainly the Western world has been facing that since we saw the effects of it in Brexit in 2016, as well as in Trump's election in 2016, that the wage of the median wage has not increased, had not increased in the US for the last 35 years, and only now in the last 3 years. So the point I'm trying to make there is that with globalization, I think all countries have to make a special effort, have to change their policies so that the bottom 50% not only do not get hurt, but they improve. And I want to mention one more reform while we are at it, one more development in India, which I think is about the most encouraging. But first and foremost, the primary responsibility of any government, especially democratic governments, is to provide benefits and improve the welfare of the bottom 50, 60%, 70%. And this government has done that much more than any other. The reform or the development that I wanted to discuss with you and wanted to mention about in India is the number. India has the largest share of STEM graduates who are women. That is, you take all college graduates, and India has the largest share in women in those. So in other words, this is something, it's an ongoing. I'm not attributing it to any one policy. This is a long-term policy. But, you know, more than the U.S., the U.S. has, I think, 9% of its workforce in STEM graduates, and India has 26% of the entire. Or if you look at only women graduates in India, that's about 43% of women graduates in India are in STEM disciplines. This is, you know, beyond remarkable, and shows that, you know, the extraordinary change that is happening in India, positive change that's happening. So I think you have large strides in education in India, especially for women. There are more female undergraduates than there are male undergraduates right now in India. Okay. Oxford University reached that status in 2018, and that has been there for 1,000 years. So, you know, we have to really be cognizant of the wide-ranging change that is happening in India. And really, you know, the elites never get hurt. So, you know, one shouldn't be looking at policy. And when they get hurt, they go and protest in the streets and make life difficult for residents of Delhi and all other India. But the policy, the primary goal of every government is to help the bottom two-thirds. And this government has done it in spades.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Let me end this episode with an excerpt from a piece Dr. Ashok Desai wrote to take stock of the 1991 reforms, 10 years after they were initiated. Dr. Desai was picked by Dr. Manmohan Singh to be the chief economic advisor on his team of reformers for the 1991 reforms. In this piece titled A Decade of Reforms, Dr. Desai wrote, "We in this country tend to think of reforms as we do of domestic repairs. Call a plumber to fix a leak, an electrician to deal with a misbehaving tube light, a mason to stop a leak. This is the thinking reflected in government announcements. There are labor reforms, power reforms, and insurance reforms, all isolated, standalone improvements, each adding to the beauty of the House of India. Actually, an economy is a machine rather than a house. Everything in it is interconnected with everything else. So if one fixes a leak in one place, it may burst a wall somewhere else. If one is to avoid expensive mistakes, one has to understand the economy as a whole. And being the finance ministry in 1991, we're not just trying to fix a leak. We were trying to improve the machine so that it would work better for all time. Such basic repairs give excellent results if they succeed. But they're also more risky, and then the economy is a machine that acts slowly. One may do something today and the effects may become evident years later. Hence, one has to understand not just the mechanics but also the dynamics of the economy. It's a terribly complicated machine. Not even the best economists understand it quite fully. And let me say quite frankly that we who undertook the reforms were not the best economists."
This was a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.